I was in media really by accident for a bunch of years, and in that space, you end up meeting so many interesting people. I've always respected this guy's candor. Though some would say he's polarizing, I personally find it to be inspiring. And his Twitter feed, man, it's off the hook. Dude's always in a debate. So next up, it's episode 5 with Torre.
What's good?
I'm chilling, man. How you doing?
I'm all right.
Pre-gamed up.
Indeed.
Indeed. It's always a good way to start. You know, hanging out with people that, you know, you don't expect to see, you know, Indeed. Catch vibes. I was, you know, it's interesting, man.
Yeah.
So welcome, welcome.
Thank you.
This is Mask Off. We're calling it You Can't Heal What You Don't Reveal.
Okay.
All right. So today, got a good friend, old friend, but I mean,
indeed.
Couple years between us.
Couple decades.
Yeah. Wow. It's interesting when you say things like that, right? But this guy, it's a long list, so hold on. Television host, novelist, author, writer, journalist, cultural essayist. That was one of my favorite. I like that one. I was like... I'm like, okay, I just, you know, cultural critic. Critic. But now these are the better parts. Son, father, Brooklynite.
Husband.
Yeah.
Still.
Husband, Brooklynite, the baddest place in the world.
Indeed, indeed. Hell yeah.
Right? Host of the Torre Show.
Mm.
Right? Which is a great show.
Thank you.
So, I want to welcome you to the show today.
Thank you.
So, you know... Like we've been talking about, you know, this is kind of like a journey. This is like a look into really kind of like yourself and who you are and kind of showing people that, you know, we're all relatable. We all go through things and we all have similar feelings and emotions. And, you know, it's normal. It's okay.
Wow, we're men talking about emotions.
Is that vulnerable?
I feel vulnerable.
You feel vulnerable? Do we need like, you know, blankets?
I don't know. My man does this weekend retreat for men.
Mm-hmm.
Where they sit and talk and share and interrogate themselves. And he's like, you know, we want you to, you know, take a look at yourself and really peer deeply into who you are. Please come join us. And I'm like, I don't know if I want to peer deeply into myself for a whole weekend with a bunch of men. But I don't know, maybe in a shorter dose.
Yeah.
Like an hour with you.
Yeah. But it's a conversation. It's not even, I don't even know if this is like a deep dive into your psyche. Like, I don't think we're like, nah, we're not doing that. We're having a conversation. This is just life talk.
Okay.
This is like where we come from. What do we do? Who are we? Like, how do I get through my day? Life throws us curveballs.
Okay.
How do I knock them out the park?
Okay.
That's it. Okay. I'm not trying to find your like deepest, darkest secrets of when and all of that. This is to say like, oh, I have feelings and emotions. So do you. And how do we deal? And yeah. That's kind of it.
Yeah.
So you're not a Brooklynite for life, though, right? That's not where you were born.
No, I grew up in Boston in a town called Randolph, suburb of Boston. Went to school in Milton, famous old high school called Milton Academy. Spent a lot of time in Dorchester and Mattapan as well. So, you know, different sides of Boston in the 70s and 80s.
What were your biggest influences up there? Cause for me, Boston, I don't have a great relationship with that place. Like, well,
my Boston growing up was an interesting duality. Cause I went to this old prep school, boarding school, ivy on the walls, waspy kids, brilliant kids, really engaged teachers, beautiful campus. This sense of beyond entitlement, like, you know, not like you should run the world because of your birth, but you should run the world because a lot is being put into you and a lot of education is happening to you and you need to give back to the world for this great, fantastic start you're getting. And so it's this sort of high-minded world over here where we're talking about big ideas and, you know, expecting a lot of each other as people in the society, you know, and studying great things in a difficult way. It was a difficult school. You had to really work. That was most of my day. But then I spent a ton of time in Dorchester at a place called Sportsman's Tennis Club. That I have written about, and it is the most ghetto tennis club you could imagine. And I don't say ghetto to mean decrepit or ratchet or bad, you know, in any way. because the place is pristine. You know, the courts are great. You know, the nets are tight. But who goes there? A lot of people who are, you know, working class or like, you know, Boston's black middle class. The place is increasingly white now. But when I was growing up, it was a very black environment. So I was going from this super white environment where we were, you know, extreme minorities in the situation. And, you know, and the place tried to be woke and progressive. And usually it was. And occasionally moments of racism would happen and the community would come together and talk about it. But then go over here to the club, which was my home away from home. I lived, I mean, people who don't know me forever, tennis is a big part of my life. I grew up playing tournaments, practicing all the time. My dad played, my sister plays. So on weekends, we'd go to the courts and play for a couple hours. And I was, you know, I was number one on the high school team, freshman to senior year. I mean, I was just, I played tournaments throughout New England growing up. You know, I came back to it as an adult in the last few years. And I'm playing tournaments in Brooklyn now. So, I mean, like, okay. I live for this. I play it very seriously. But it was like, it was this super black world. And it was really, really cool to have both of those things that I was sort of rubbing up against and, like, learning from. And I never felt like, oh, I'm so torn. What am I really? It was like, I can kind of do both these things. And I can kind of fail in both these worlds as well. But, you know, like, I like both these worlds, and I can embrace having this two-ness.
I can't picture this club, man. I'm thinking of Boston, and that's not my picture of Boston. Like, so who's playing there? Like, and how do you get into this club, and why do you go to this club?
There was no membership fee. Okay, it was when I was growing up, it was a not-for-profit that was started by this guy named Jim Smith, this epic man who developed connections throughout Boston so he could call the mayor, he could call Andrew Young, he could call Jesse Jackson, these sort of people, you know, and luminaries throughout the black tennis world. And Arthur Ashe would come to the club once or twice a year and give a speech, because there was a mission to the place that adults will pay, and this was a phrase, adults will pay so kids can play.
Nice.
So it was a lot of kids from the projects and from the hood who were coming and getting really, really cheap tennis lessons. And the mission was, we're going to develop some of you through years of intense coaching to get a college scholarship that you would not have had a chance to get. So it was like, imagine the local YMCA decides, we're just going all in on tennis. We don't do anything but tennis. And maybe that'll be more like, when I start from the vision of a tennis club, you're like, I don't understand. But yeah, when I start from the vision of the YMCA, it just says, just tennis, with the mission of getting you kids into college. And then you start to see like, oh, I can envision that.
Yep. Yeah.
And yeah, I grew up with a lot of people, like a group of like 10 people who, you know, some were from working class, some were from middle class, and really got a lot out of the character building experience of like playing tennis with a demanding coach and, you know, usually a black coach as well, who was kind of cool in his or her own way. Because there's a lot of really good black players who went to college D1, didn't make to the pros for whatever reason. So we had a steady stream of those sort of people. And, you know, it was just a fun place, you know? And some of the people who I grew up with went to be a producer for the Oprah show, went to be an investment advisor at Merrill Lynch. Another one of the sisters I grew up with owns a bunch of yoga studios around here in Manhattan. So, I mean, you know, folks were learning whatever they were learning from tennis. I mean, like, we had a very serious hobby. I never did anything else after school or beyond school but this. I didn't really do swimming that much, didn't really do the karate. I didn't have a pluralistic after school. It was always tennis every after school, every summer, all. And it was that way for a lot of us. So for 10 years, this was all we were ever doing outside of school. And you learn a lot about yourself in terms of learning how to acquire something like a body of knowledge.
Yep.
Like when I wanted to become a writer, I had an idea of how to do it from how I had been taught tennis.
Mm.
So I was like, I know how to acquire that. And it also made me, I don't want to say immune to pressure, but I just dealt with so much pressure as a youth in tennis. We were going to tournaments all the time.
Yeah.
And it's a lot of pressure. You're out there with this other kid who's trying to kick your ass. You're yep. trying to kick his ass. You're not going to tie. You're either going to win or lose.
One on one.
You know, and in New England, you had to play in like, I think, four of the five states to qualify for a ranking. So you had to drive to Connecticut, New Hampshire, Vermont to like get enough tournaments that counted in. So I mean, like,
to get your ranking.
So if we drove to fucking New Hampshire and you lose in the first round, you know, somebody's kind of pissed, you know, and they're not like mad at you, but it's like, damn. Like,
and that's the coaches driving? This is your parents driving? Or this
usually
is...
my parents. Usually my mom was driving me. But occasionally there might be a coach that would drive us if a bunch of us from the club were going to play at a certain place. But you definitely felt the pressure, you know, when there's parents and coaches and your peers watching, you know, either literally there or you're going to get back and they'll be like, how'd you do in the... the tournament over there. Like, yeah, you know, I got to the semis. I got, you know, I lost in the second round, whatever, you know. And so it was a lot of pressure. And I just remember feeling very comfortable with pressure and not feeling like I am paralyzed by it just because I had been baptized into it so much at a young age. And when I started doing television, it was a similar sort of pressure. Like, you better perform now. Go.
Toss it up, serve, yeah. Go.
People are watching, like, go. And I remember feeling like the tennis experience dealing with pressure made me so that I wasn't nervous to do television. And I think that was a big reason why people found me captivating, because I was very comfortable and I wasn't nervous. And other people were more nervous and thus more conservative in just how they presented their ideas.
Costume. Was it a specific like play or loss or something in tennis or a coach or a strategy? Like what made you so confident in the game? I mean, tennis is a hard game. I played tennis for a year in high school.
Yeah.
Right. So you're playing, it's not like golf where they say it's golf is one on one and you're not really one on one. You're playing next to a couple of people.
Yeah.
But tennis is super like you're back and forth.
Yeah.
And it's psychological. And like you said, you're young. Everybody's watching.
Yeah.
People are talking, but not really paying attention also at the same time because there's tons of other matches. So you're really having this match with that person.
Yeah.
Like that.
Yeah.
Right? So what was the skill set that got you over that and really just laser focused on always accomplishing that and not the loss or anything else stopping you?
You know, my father was always very confident. He never seemed to be down. He never seemed to be even stopped or defeated, you know, by the day, but you know, like whatever would happen in the day, whatever was going on in life, he was always confident. He was always willing to bet on himself. He never seemed to be depressed or down. You know, when you would play a game with him, either he loved to play chess, backgammon, tennis, you know, pretty much anything. But, you know, he would always compete. And to the last second, he would still think he would be able to find some way to win. And he spoke to me about that. And he transmuted that to me without speaking as well. And just the habit of confidence and feeling like I can do it. I can do it. And never really seeing the example of like, I always lose. Like he would never say something like that. And I know people who like say things like that, like, oh, it never goes my way. I'm like, you're crazy. Like, why would you even think like that?
Yeah.
Like, why would you know? And but I just came from a fantastic example of a mind that was very directed and forward and positive. I mean, you could tell, you know, my father's internal messages were very positive. I can do it. You know, I'm going to figure it out. I can get this done. You know, it's, yeah, he just passed like 3 weeks ago.
Oh, man, my condolences.
Yeah, yeah, it's new.
That's a heavy one.
Yeah.
And was it a long time coming or was it a fast?
Yeah, no, it was because he had dementia for about 2 years. So he was floating downward in that period. You know, when he started, he could kind of talk. On the road down, he could still talk. And then toward the end, it was just gibberish. And, you know, he couldn't really have any sort of conversation with you at all the last few months. And, you know, the very end kind of saw it coming. And so, you know, he, in a way, did his best to, like, give us a cushion,
mm-hmm.
you know, and just ease us into the idea of not going to be with you anymore. And then, like, ducking out. And he wasn't in pain. So, you know, you can hold on to that. And, you know, it's crazy to say, but it's like my favorite funeral ever. My sister put together everything, is in a little funeral home in Boston. And, you know, all these people said really nice things about him, from, you know, his little niece, right, grandniece, really, to, like, people who had worked for him. He was an accountant, so other accountants who worked under him. He had his own firm, to their wives being like, you know, he did a lot for my husband, to, you know, all sorts of people just saying, like, really, really nice things. And, you know, it was like, it was an honorable life.
Yep.
You know, he's a stand-up guy, you know, like, took care of us, you know, was good to people. And you can cling to those things and it doesn't like kill you. You know what I mean?
Kill you in what sense? The loss.
Just to break you down.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was waiting for the time that I would, like, you know, crumble into tears. And it hasn't happened. You know, when my wife told me, because my sister called her, you know, I was like, ah, oh. But, you know, we kind of knew we were close to the end. And so I didn't burst out. And I thought, okay, this first couple of days I'm in shock, so I'm not going to, but, you know, it'll break. And it never really happened. And there were times when I was like, am I not sufficiently sad? Am I blocking it? Or am I just weirdly not being sad enough? Yeah. And
how do you measure that?
I don't know.
Right?
I don't know.
I mean, I think you just try to feel through it. What did you feel?
I mean, I think about him, you know, and I miss him, you know.
But you sound content. Like, you sound almost like, not content in the sense you're okay with losing. I'm saying content in, like, you fulfilled, right? Like, you're not missing anything from him. And it sounds like from the funeral, he had an incredible send-off.
Yeah.
Sounded like people loved him. So he must have left a good positive legacy, right, behind. Right. So maybe you are in the right way, and you shouldn't be sad. Like, I don't think sadness is usually ego. Like, that's us being hurt that they're gone and we can't have them anymore.
Mm.
But if they've done their time here and they've done, it sounds like your father had a great life, put you in a great position, your family in a great position.
Mm-hmm.
What's wrong with that? We all leave the planet. We all go.
No, that's right. And he was 86. So, I mean, you know, it's a long time. It's definitely less. We've been through, you and I have a lot of funerals that were younger folks.
Way younger.
Which is much
two
younger.
Last year.
Yeah. So you were at Ed's funeral?
No, I was at Prodigy's and Reggie's.
Oh, because I remember I saw you at Reggie's.
Yeah.
But no, I knew Prodigy. I worked with him, but I didn't go to his funeral. I didn't feel I was that close.
That was a tough one for me.
No, I know. I know. You know? And we had Dominic Trinneer's memorial last year as well. Yeah. There's a lot of young-ish death. And did you know Gary Harris?
Yes, I knew Gary, but I didn't like Pachet. Like, nah, crazy. And then Garnett. And then Garnett Reed before that. And
I didn't know him.
Yeah, so this
it's been a lot.
It's a ton. One of the young kids from ASAP, my young man Pressy, just so it's like it's a ton. It's a ton. It's a ton, right?
How old?
He was 20s, you know. Yeah, he got shot and had a brain aneurysm, and it kind of relapsed. And yeah,
you know what happened too last year? One of the parents at my kid's school was skateboarding in the city amidst like the cars. And like apparently he was like really good at that, and he was there was something, he was touching a truck or something, and something happened, and two young kids.
Yeah,
that's the thing that always is like the knife through the heart to me. Like two young kids, three young kids, whatever. Like, you know, even if they're not young, like three kids who haven't even reached college just lost their dad or their mom. Like.
I mean, especially to something like that, like the accidents, man. But yeah, death is a tough one, man. Mm. But it's like, you know, again, we talk about
it
all the time.
It doesn't make me think of my own mortality. Like people, I've heard people say that. Mm-hmm. I make me think of the other person.
Yeah.
It totally gets you out of you. As I'm really fixated on, you know, dad number one, and I have new fixation on my mom to take care of her. Now, I mean, they were together 60 years. So, like, wow. She is a huge void that, you know, like, the house is empty, and it never was. It's definitely externally directive, like, pushes me outside of myself to think about them.
Yeah, I don't think we're not supposed to mourn. You're supposed to celebrate, right?
Yeah, I didn't feel like that. I mean, like, it would be nice to feel that. Mm-hmm. And on paper, I should.
So then what did you feel? If you said you didn't feel sad enough, but then you said you didn't feel like you should celebrate, where in the middle or somewhere in between?
I don't even know what to call it. I mean, I was in shock longer than I realized.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I thought I was...
Denial?
Well, the denial would be that the moment he passed, I was like, oh. And then I was like, okay, how soon can I get to mom, right? I live in New York. She's in Boston. Mm-hmm. And there was something I had to do the next day, and I'm like, if I miss that, it's really going to screw me up. So I gotta... But I'll be there by, like, you know, 2 o'clock or whatever. Like, okay. And, you know, my sister was on her way anyway. And, you know, I got there and I tried to just, you know, like, and she wasn't weepy. She was chilled, but, you know, still obviously going through it. And I just try to be there for her and not leave her alone and just hang out with her and, you know, just help her out in whatever little ways, just being next to her. And I was there for like 3 days doing that.
Yep.
Until I was like, wait a minute, this is for me too. Like, I had only perceived all of this.
It only happened to her.
This march to the funeral, this multi-day march to the funeral, because he passed on, I believe it was Monday, and the funeral was Saturday. And it was about 3 days into it before I was like, oh, this is for me too. It's not just for her. Like, this is my dad. Like, I was only perceiving it as, like, you know, her husband, as weird as it sounds. And it just took me a while to make that deeper level connection of, like, oh, this is my funeral, too.
Mm.
I don't know. I don't know what to call it. I feel, you know, it's hard.
Somewhere in between.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But then, you know, do you push through it and figure out what that is, or do we knock it to the side?
Oh, man. I mean, you know.
That's a tough, you know. How do we deal with those?
You know, I did ayahuasca once.
How was that? I've been thinking about that, but it seems
it's the shit.
It just seems so intense.
You know? Oh, it's so intense. It's so intense. It's totally the shit. But just to the point we were talking about, occasionally in my ayahuasca journey, through my mind and the deep recesses of my memory, I would come to a place where I knew if I go through that door, it's going to be painful. And even in the grips of ayahuasca, I had the presence of mind to be like, I'm not going through that door. I want a happy experience. And I would turn and go back to the happy. And I pretty successfully avoided. And I don't know if I went on that trip again, I may not be able to resist that. But I had a happy trip. I was so fucking happy. I wasn't upset at all. And so, I knew I could have been. I knew I could have. I could have thought my way into that and then go through a depressed hour or whatever. And I'm like, no, GPS says turn. I'm turning.
But that's a key, right? Because that's our choice.
Yes.
Right? And having that conscious choice is big.
Yes.
A lot of times, like, we choose to be mad. We choose to say...
mad feels, yes, we choose to be mad. Mad feels like less of a conscious choice to me, right?
It's like, a reaction, like, more so than a response.
Like I can choose to be happy, but like mad feels like something is dragging me in that direction. And I never want to be mad. But like if I'm there, it's like, you know, I'm being pulled there. I don't want to be there.
Mm-hmm. Does it take practice to get that? Like, for me, it takes meditation to even think about being that mindful or that aware in those moments.
How much do you meditate?
I just started, so I haven't been doing it that long.
How long you started?
I started August or July of last year. August of last year.
Oh, okay.
Right?
Twice a day?
I do once a day for the most part. Sometimes I'll do twice a day. But I usually I'm up to about 30 minutes of just meditation in the morning.
Really?
Yeah. So I get up in the morning. I have like a full routine for my day. I get up, I take vitamins. I go and do a shot of apple cider vinegar, CBD, honey, and water. I brush my teeth. And then I write morning pages. So I do those three pages. And then I meditate for about a half an hour, or I do.
Tim Ferriss over here.
I'm on a.
You are crushing the morning.
I'm crushing my morning, bro.
Really, morning pages every morning.
Every morning. So I've been doing that.
And then you meditate 30 minutes.
30 minutes. Yeah. So if I have to leave somewhere at 8 o'clock, I got to get up that much earlier. Or
you get up earlier to make sure you get your thing done.
Yeah. And even when I'm like hopping on planes, like I'll meditate like on the plane right before it takes off.
Right.
So as takeoff, you're kind of going into that. So I'll figure out. So I'll move it around. So but it takes me that to get to that point of being conscious in those moments. Because sometimes I respond too fast or react. I react. I don't respond. And, you know, I can't. Like, you've always had that demeanor, that calm demeanor to me.
Oh, like, okay.
Behind closed doors, I wonder. But. I'm joking.
No, I get you. Well, go ahead.
But your demeanor has always been that. So for me, I look at that and it's like, that's what I look at is kind of that clarity, that choice, like we were discussing before.
Okay.
Right?
Okay.
You have a choice. You don't want to be mad. And you know that.
I mean, you know, a long time ago, I started really thinking about, you don't have to listen to all the thoughts in your head. You don't have to pay attention and take seriously all the thoughts in your head.
Yep.
You can focus on the positive thoughts and the uplifting thoughts. And to feel a sense of executive control over the mind.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like for a lot of people, just the way they seem to describe it, the mind seems to be a thing that controls them.
Subconscious.
And the thoughts occur to them and they just follow the thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than saying, I am in control.
Mm-hmm.
There's not some, you know, it's like there's the conscious mind and then there's the other mind, which subconscious, I don't know, maybe whatever is actually giving me the thoughts, and that controls me, mm-hmm. rather than I ignore 20 to 30% of the thoughts in my head to focus on the positive. And probably even a lesser percentage than that, because I have trained myself a long time ago, I don't even think about it anymore, to be positive and to think. And I realize sometimes I allow myself to get screwed because somebody, for whatever reason, will give me like a shitty deal. And I'll be like, and I don't mean like a business deal, but just like, mm-hmm. oh, you go that way and I'll go this way. And I should be like, no, but I'll be like, I'll make it work. Like, mm-hmm. whatever you say, I'll make it work. I'll figure it out. Like, I'll find, you know, I could be in a car that's teetering off the cliff about to fall out. I'm like, oh, I'll figure it out. I'll find some way. We'll figure it out. Don't worry. You know, like, just, you have to have the confidence that we will figure this out and then we can go to the next level. But like, it's just always, you know, there was a time, when was that? I think it was my early 20s when I really wanted to be positive. And I would, if I had a negative self-thought, I would pinch the back of my neck.
Wow.
Like, really hard. And like, to associate that, I didn't even remember that.
So you just really conditioned yourself.
Oh, yeah. I don't want negative self-thoughts.
But that was just out of the blue? Like, you just decided, or somebody taught you that, or did you see another, like...
I'm not sure where that came from. I don't know that it came from out of the blue. I think I was a psychology major for a little while. That was my first major in college. And, you know, I remember we studied Pavlov's dogs and those sort of conditioning things. And I must have gotten the idea from somewhere of, you know, associating a pain mm-hmm. with those thoughts would help me drive that out of my mind, hopefully. And
you're doing your own shock therapy.
Absolutely. Right? Absolutely. I mean, it was like, let's be real. Like, let's be like, where is it really going to hurt? And like, if you really like fucking go there, like, you will make this change. And, you know, it ultimately goes to what I was saying about executive control of your mind and not letting your mind control you.
Yep.
And that, I mean, I was a young person and trying to establish executive control over my mind. And that was part of how I had to do it.
That shit is awesome. I'm this age still working on that. Like, in meditation, part of the meditations are affirmations.
Yeah.
One of the affirmations is, I am the master of my emotions.
Yes.
Right?
Like, you gotta believe that shit.
Nobody else can. Like, so everybody's like, yo, why are you making me so upset right now? I hate you. Like, if I'm making you do something, give me all your money. Give me. And you're gonna say no. Right? So.
I'm making you upset. Yeah. Yeah. Right?
So college, what happened in college? Psychology major was your first major.
Yeah.
Then.
I mean, you know, college was formative, you know, as it is for everybody. I mean, the core moment that I usually think about was as backstory. Freshman year, I started my social life on campus by being friends with the kids on my hall. I happened to be the only, I went to Emory in Atlanta, mm-hmm. happened to be the only black kid in that group, which at that moment of just going to college did not bother me,
mm-hmm.
Ended up being in this white social circle, not trying to extract myself, but like, that just happened and I just flowed with it.
But you were cool from that from your time in Boston, everything else was kind of natural, right? Wasn't
sure. I mean,
different.
I mean,
you said you went back and forth to school.
Yeah, I had black and white friends growing up. Yeah. So I mean, it you know,
it wasn't like you were going to feel weird,
right?
Yeah.
And at some point, I became aware that the black kids were like, "What is he doing? What's up with him? How come he didn't hang out with us?" That whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was like that kid, like the black kid who didn't hang out with the white kids freshman year. Mm-hmm. Didn't hang out with the black kids freshman year. they didn't know I wasn't like rejecting them. I just had fallen into this social circle. But it looked bad. In retrospect, it looked bad. Yep. It looked like you are rejecting the black community on campus. And we know that's a bad thing in college. So the story's going somewhere. I went home after freshman year and something said, okay, we're going to read the autobiography of Malcolm X now.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to stop talking about reading it and just fucking read it. And I read it, and it was revolutionary for me and freaking blew my mind, as it does, as it did for so many people.
Yep.
Like us. And I said, I'm going to go back to school and be totally different. And I'm not hanging with them anymore. I want to be with my brothers and sisters.
Yep.
And so now, wanting to be down sophomore year when I had not been down freshman year, they were like, we don't know about you.
Oh.
But right there, like, prove yourself. But like, I was genuinely, you know, wanting to be one of them. So now I'm showing up in the black table at lunch all the time, and I'm meeting everybody, and I'm going to all the parties. And so at first they were standoffish, but soon they were like, oh, he's serious. He wants to be down with us. So, okay. And I mean, he keeps showing up. Like, you can't deny him.
Let's give him a chance.
He just, I mean, yeah, he's part of the college community and he keeps coming over here. He didn't before and now he does. And that was the year that I started dating this black med student and I changed my major to AFAM, African American Studies, AAAS. And I started a black nationalist newspaper on campus called The Fire This Time that ran for as long as I was in school. Very controversial. And then at the end of the year, I was able to finagle one of the three spots on campus to live in the black house, right?
Oh, okay.
We called it the black house. It was the house that the African-American Studies Department controlled, and it was like way off campus, but it was nice, and it was just the three of us, and we could have and we could have parties there, and like when the party was happening, like we were kind of like running and hosting and controlling the party. So it was kind of an honor to be there, even though it was a little further off campus. And so there were pros and cons. So you were really accepting something, but you had to be cool with the African American Studies Department to even be considered to live. So if I was living there, I was in my junior year, I lived there. I was clearly down like that. And right. And I had this girlfriend, and like this black med student girlfriend who's like 10 years older than me. And I had, and she was dope. Right? She was brilliant and she was dope. And I'm running the paper and I'm a AFAM major, right? And all the shit. And so we go to have this party and, you know, the black student party, the BSA, and, you know, everybody's there. And at previous parties, this is innocuous, right? At previous parties, we had told everybody, hey, just help us clean up a little bit at the end of the night. We're not asking you to be a cleanup crew, but just put some shit in the trash can so that we don't have to do like a 2-hour cleanup after y'all leave. Like, you know, we're not the cleanup crew either. And we had said that, you know, and like another party was ending and everyone's heading for the door and like not, and we're like looking at like the fucking gigantic mess that we're about to be left with. And I said something innocuous, like, come on, y'all, can you help us clean up? Like something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And this chick turned around and was like, shut up, Torre, you ain't black. Right in front of everybody, right? And I had to tell the story that way because that relates back to freshman year.
Mm-hmm.
That's why she would say that.
Yep.
And in retrospect, I'm like, I'm living in the black house and still you say that. But also, I had no retort. I didn't know what to say. I didn't say anything. I mean, like, she said that shit. The music had been cut off, right? It was like a movie. It was like
you could hear a pin drop.
Oh my God. It was a Dear White People perfect moment, right? Of like the music has ended everyone's about to leave, so everybody's paying attention. I kind of got everybody's attention, like, come on, y'all. Like, I'm like, hey, you know, help us with the cleanup. You know, I wasn't angry or cursing at them. I knew you can't get 30 black people or 30 any people to, like, do what you say. We're like, yo, what the fuck? Like, it was more like, yo, come on, y'all. Like, help us with the cleanup. Like, what the fuck? Come on. Like, we live here. You know? Like, we've talked about this before. Come on. Shut up, Torre. You ain't black. Like, and, like, everybody's watching and everybody's listening. And I was like, oh, shit. And it fucking killed me. And I felt so small and so humiliated. Oh, I said, did I say it was a girl? It was a guy. It was a guy.
Oh, it was a guy?
It was a guy. And he was huge. And he was from Alabama. Oh,
well, that changes the whole.
And I had never heard him speak ever. Right? We didn't get down at all. I didn't even know what his voice was like. He was like I don't think he was a football player, but it was like a football lineman type dude who's just like hanging out, never really talks, like, you know. So he said that shit. And I mean, I wasn't going to fight anybody. I wasn't about that. And what would that prove, right?
Yep.
But it was, I felt humiliated. And I turned and I just went in my room and I closed the door. I didn't cry, but it was like, wow, that was fucking painful.
Yeah.
And I had to fucking deal with that. And I'm just having this one thought for fucking hours. And then it was like, okay, I'm going to fucking put this away and hide this.
Mm-hmm.
And not think about this anymore because it's extremely painful. And that lasted for like half an hour or something. and
doesn't work well.
No. And but also because I was a writer.
Mm.
I was a young writer,
mm-hmm.
but I was a writer. And, you know, I had the paper that I was putting out, and I had a column in the big Emory Wheel, the school paper. It was called 40 Inches in a Pen.
40 Inches in a Pen.
And so I wrote about it.
In
the school paper.
Okay.
I wrote like 800 word essay. And normally my editorials were 500 words, but this was longer. I had more to say.
Uh-oh.
And I kind of told a truncated version of the story I told you. And this whisper that had been following me, and the guy, this is what the guy said to me, and this is how I feel about that. And, you know, and obviously, you know, the notion that you can define who and who isn't black is absurd.
Yep.
And, you know, that I perform blackness differently than you doesn't mean I'm not, like, you know, and I heard later that he wanted to beat me up after he saw that in the paper. I didn't say his name or anything because it wasn't about him. It
wasn't about that, yeah.
But the whole black community was there. They didn't hear about it. They were there in the room.
So everybody knew anyway.
So everybody knew he wrote an essay in a school paper about him. I never saw him again, which is kind of weird. The campus wasn't that big, but he lived off campus, and I don't know. But it was definitely a formative experience in my time at Emory, and probably a formative piece of the book that I would do about blackness and the breath.
Of course.
You know, who's afraid of post-blackness? The breath of what blackness actually is.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, that's a bugged out situation. So the writer, I mean, but your writing became therapy.
Mm, yeah. Well, I mean, you know, yeah, I had to.
You got it out.
I had to, you know, yeah.
You know, I mean, that's how you dealt with it, right? Instead of pushing it away, you said,
yeah,
let me deal with it the best way I can. I don't have a therapist. Here's my therapy.
I mean, a lot of times.
Let me write it out.
A lot of times you don't fully know what you think until you try to write about it.
Mm.
You can't always fully articulate the thought in your head alone, but trying to write it, I think something in the physical act of writing and the act of putting it into real sentences and paragraphs makes you really pull out the real meanings of it, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
I mean, you got to think it through a lot harder. You got to flesh everything out. You got to flesh all those ideas out, and then you got to string them together and put them together so they make sense.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah,
and that's a tough skill. I mean, it takes a while, right?
Yeah.
Was that something that bit you early? Like, when did you start writing? Was it just the newspaper?
The newspaper was definitely a time, the college paper was definitely a time when I was thinking about, you know, I love writing and media and this is Fly and I could be part of this. I wrote for the high school paper in high school. So I had already had some experience with that. And that was great. It was funny because in high school, I used to hang with the black guys on the basketball team who were a year, 2 years older than me. But see, this is the, like, the Emory people, like, I was like, I was like,
if they would have known my people,
I mean, yeah,
in high school, they wouldn't question my blackness.
Exactly.
Like, fuck.
Exactly. That was my crew in freaking high school, right? You know,
you could have FaceTimed them. Why didn't you FaceTime them?
No, right. We didn't have fucking iPhones. Oh my God. And I remembered them. And I was writing for the paper like roundups of the basketball games, and the players. My friends, the core players in the team, were saying it was really the coach, and they were breaking down, like, you know, off in the dorm, like, here's what the coach is not doing, and he's pissing us off, and blah, blah, blah. And so I've, you know, I didn't kill the guy. I just wrote a typical short post-game review and that the team had lost. It was like their third or fourth loss in a row or something. And there was like a line or two that was critical of the coach. And it was a big problem. I mean, like, administration level problem.
You got sent to the principal's office?
I mean, in effect, yeah. Like, I had to go sit with the principal. I mean, it's a big prep school. Like, everybody knew the principal. It wasn't like, he's a scary guy. He's, you know, Mr. Foster. He's a nice guy. But he was kind of like, you can't do that. And I was kind of like, why not? You know, and it wasn't like a gratuitous attack. It wasn't.
It wasn't slanderous.
Yeah, I didn't feel it was slanderous or out of line, but it was like, there's clearly a problem here. And, you know, I, from my information, he's not bringing it. I remember that as an early experience of like feeling very much media and just sort of the whole thing of like, when people are listening and responding to what you're doing,
you affect them some way.
Very exciting. And when it's a positive response, it's really exciting. But sometimes it's not. If you step up to the plate enough, there's going to be times when people get pissed off about what you say. And I've had plenty of times when people are pissed off about what I said.
You know.
And I wasn't trying to piss anybody off. I wasn't trying to be like a shock jock and in people. But, you know, I mean, definitely the first 10, 15 years of my career when I was feeling like, you know, ascending, like, you know, yeah, it was definitely like, you know, you know, I'm going to have to show y'all I'm willing to shoot a motherfucker so you understand, like, I'm going to be that dude. Like, I want to be, you know, noticed and remembered out of this. So, you know, if I got to shoot somebody, like, figuratively,
for sure.
Definitely
this
not.
This pen goes off, son.
Oh, right. The
this
pen
goes off.
I mean, you know, I remember when Public Enemies album came out, and it was their first, and I was the biggest Public Enemy fan.
Yeah, we haven't even spoken about hip hop yet. That's a.
I mean, Chuck D came to campus when I was at Emory. I motivated that. I made that fucking happen. I interviewed him for the school paper. I freaking created the donation fund to be able to get Chuck to come to the campus. I mean, the guy.
So he came by himself, not Public Enemy.
Oh, no. He came by himself for a speech. It was not a concert.
Yep.
And I remember, and I hung out with him and Hank Shockley like all day. And like just listening to the way that they would talk about things was very motivational. I was a huge Public Enemy fan. They were my number one group. And when they released Music in Our Message, I was like, that album was terrible. You guys have lost it completely. And I didn't understand, you know, the way that a recording career can go and how that can happen. And, you know, just have a little more understanding and empathy for the way an artist's career may go. I didn't have that. I wouldn't do this now. But at that time, I was young enough that I was hurt personally.
Yeah. That you let me down. They let you down.
Yeah. I mean, it was like, you know, there would be like a year of not having a Public Enemy, right? Because like to get a dope Public Enemy album, that was like a year that I could sit and listen to it and vibe off of it. I remember I was fucking in England because in my college had a psychology trip that we went to England for like 2 weeks or something studying little kids. And I would jog listening to Fear of a Black Planet. And I could listen to it every day and hear something new. Some lyrics, some samples, some... I mean, like, it was so exciting. So when Music and Our Message came out, and the album sucked, and Public Enemy had meant so much to me, I was so hurt. And I wrote the review for Rolling Stone.
Mm-hmm.
And the review began, I guess by now... we should be used to seeing black heroes die in public. And it went down from there.
Ouch. Then it went down from there?
Oh, yeah. And it came from a real place that I was very hurt that this album sucked. And you know, it came from a real place. You know, I was definitely also... not afraid to shoot a motherfucker. And that was, in terms of hip-hop at that point, it was like, you went up to the biggest motherfucker in the room and shot him in the face.
Yeah.
And there was only, if memory serves, there was only two reviewers that season out of the folks who did big hip-hop reviews who were willing to say it was a bad album. And I remember getting run up on at like a conference. People said shit on the street, you know, but what do you, but I was willing to do that. I wouldn't do that now. I don't even want to do a review now, like, because I don't want to do a negative review.
You want to do a little Yachty album?
Yo, I fuck with Yachty. Yeah. I fuck with Yachty hard, man.
I always tell people he's the new generation's Biz Markie. Like that kind of vibe.
Yeah,
vibe, not lyric, sure, vibe. Vibes.
Yeah, no, but he's I mean, and Biz Markie is dope, yeah, but
a vibe.
Yachty's dope. Yachty, for me, I was doing a story on Migos.
Yeah, for Rolling Stone.
For Rolling Stone, and I was not, no shots, I was not a fan of Migos before. I didn't really know that much about them.
Yep.
You know, I wasn't down on them, I just didn't know that much about them. When they said do Migos, I had to research.
Yeah.
And I like their music. And I remember we're at the photo shoot. So I was on to Migos. I was not on to the surrounding universe of Migos yet. Okay?
Oh, so you just got on the Yachty after the Migos thing.
Yo,
whoa,
this
okay.
Kid walks in the room when we're doing the photo shoot in a gray sweatsuit, top and bottom. The sneakers were ill. I forget what they were, but they were fucking ill. And he's got the fucking lampshade red braids around. And he walks in silently with this cool ass walk and goes over to Quavo and silently just puts his hand out. And they do this epic, elaborate, like 8 maneuver handshake. And then he goes to Offset, and they do the same thing, but slightly different. And they're both in tune with. And I'm like, who the fuck is that nigga? And I really didn't know, is he, you know, the biggest dealer in the block? Is he a manager? I knew it was the one, the manager, but I have no idea who he is. But that motherfucker has presence. He has it.
Yeah.
And he kind of took over the sound system and was playing new songs from the record that was about to come out. And then when I sat with him in the studio, because it was like Yachty's in Studio A, Offset's in B, you know, Quavo's in C, right?
Okay.
So I'm going back and forth. And I'm like, yo, this motherfucker is cool.
Yeah.
And then I started listening to the music. And I hadn't recently had that experience of going backwards into like persona and then into the sound. Yo, I fucks with dude. I like his sound.
I mean, he came up watching as a kid, Dungeon Family,
right,
and all of that because of his father.
He is a kid.
Well, his father was a photographer.
Right.
Or is a photographer.
He's a baby.
Yeah, he's like, what, 23?
Two or three?
Yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah, and creative director of Nautica or whatever it is.
I mean, when I first heard the name, I was definitely like,
Little Boat.
Yes, but then, you know, getting to know him and then getting to know his music.
I mean, isn't hip hop crazy? Like the evolution and what,
you know, I like to find things that I like about hip hop. I don't want to be like the guy who's like, oh, in my day, you know, we rapped the whole verse.
But we didn't like everything in hip hop.
No.
There's tons of things we didn't like.
No, we bricked a lot of shit, but I don't want to be the old guy who's dissing the new music.
No, for sure.
You know, I mean, I'll shit on Lil Xan, you know, anytime you want, but I want to be like, you know, I understand Migos, I understand Yachty, you know, like I get, you know, fucking Nipsey, I fucking dig this one, that one, whatever, you know, I mean, ASAP, like Ferg, you know, ASAP Rocky's the shit.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you know, Tyler, when Tyler the Creator blew up, you know, you heard that buzz coming first,
mm-hmm.
right? That single was a monster.
Monster. And then the video.
Yes, the video was a monster.
You know.
And I loved that right away. And when I got the album, I was like, please let me like this. Because I want to be able to be continuing to understand and feel what's hot in hip-hop.
And connected. Like and connected. And it's connected. Hard. It's like it beats.
Yes. I mean, like I knew it was going to be hot. It's just, will I like it and understand it and get it or not? And, yeah. You know, when we were in our 20s and 30s, it, like, I was like, the culture has to prove itself to me. Like, mm-hmm. I'll brick Public Enemy. I'll brick LL. I don't give a fuck, you know? Now I'm like, if I don't like what's hot, is it me? Is it I've aged out that I don't understand what the millennials are doing and thinking about? And, you know, so I wouldn't feel comfortable to stand on a soapbox and be like, all y'all are wrong, Yachty's actually whack. Or all y'all are wrong, you know, like Lil Uzi Vert is actually whack. Like when I was like, no, all y'all wrong, this new Public Enemy is whack,
mm-hmm.
you know. And I'll fucking stand up in public and say that shit. I don't give a fuck.
Yeah.
I wouldn't, you know, because of my age, I wouldn't feel comfortable doing that now. I want to be in the party with these motherfuckers. They're still having fun.
They are
changing hip hop. You know, it's fun. I want to be down with their movement.
And why not? It's simple. It's like, it's a fun thing. I love the hip hop shit now. Migos is dope. I defend Migos all the time.
Yeah.
Like their ad libs, the way they do the ad libs alone, they should just write a book on ad libs.
Yo, they make sure to put the ad-libs in the pocket.
So yeah, all the time. Like I was reading in the article. What did he say? He uses his voice as the kick and...
The snare.
The snare, and it's like he...
So they're accenting.
An instrument. Yeah.
I didn't even realize that until I really listened through it and like, yo, they're dope.
But I learned that through cooking now, what I do with food, right?
Okay.
So how we cook, it might be comfort food. It might be mac and cheese. It might be fried chicken, but our fried chicken takes 3 days to make.
Okay, what do you do?
Well, technique. So you dry brine, right? Because if you want to do fried chicken, you want to have super dry, crispy skin.
Yeah.
Right? So you do a salt and a little bit of starch, dries it out, pulls all the moisture out, and you dry that off. And then you either season it or you can go to a wet brine or whatever else for the night. So if you want a buttermilk brine, you want to do whatever else. And then you go and do a one first fry, and then you might put it in the fridge for the next day, and then you do a second fry.
You fry it
twice
and then fry it again the next day.
Yeah.
I gotta try that. Yeah. I am far too lazy in the kitchen to do all that. Like, but I'll make myself do it just to see if I can.
Yep.
But generally, I'm like, yo, how fast can I
but
make?
But then it's passion.
Oh,
I think
get
it comes
you.
To that. Like, no, it's like, right, I'm far too lazy to do the research and journalistic endeavors.
No, totally. I would probably spend more time on my ability or whatever as a writer is not some natural thing. I probably spend more time on mine than you do on yours. And I don't mean you, Mike. I mean you. Other writers of my generation, other writers of the next generation. I remember when I went to Columbia for creative writing graduate school.
Mm-hmm.
And the first piece we did, like, that, you know, we got a prompt and then we each read it in the class. And then we talked about it as a group. And we came out and there was like five of us who were like recognized, like we're all really good. We're like standing around and they were all like, how long did you spend? How long did you spend? and I didn't create that conversation. I remember the girl who did, and I could tell later she had aimed for me to be last in the asking. And I felt like when she said, how long did you spend? And I could tell, I felt like an extra quiet. Like, you know, the E.F. Hutton, the old E.F. Hutton commercials? Like, they were all like, we really want to know how long you spent. You know, because your shit was really good. How long did you spend? And I spent longer on mine than they all had. And, you know, it's a piece of writing.
Mm-hmm.
It's a piece of art. If I spend longer on it than you, it's probably going to be better. Now, that's not necessarily like a one-to-one basis. It kind of could be, but I mean, like, I've been doing this so long that I've chunked a lot of those decisions that I can get there faster than I could 10 years ago.
Yeah.
But just as a general matter, if I keep spending more time, I mean, like, digging through, like, the tiny shit, like how to make a sentence better. Like, it really can be, like, one word. Pull out one phrase and it makes it really pop and really zip, and you pull out the fat out of the sentences and it makes it really fast, and the reader feels the difference.
Yep, but doesn't know why.
No, they don't know why.
That's the great part.
They don't know why.
And that's the whole point, right? So just like
I mean, if you're a writer, you know why.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I see it, you know, sometimes people send me their writing and you'll see, like, you know, double verbs or too many adjectives or, you know, phrases too long, these sentences are conjoined, they should be cut into two, you know, and it's like, you know, there's little things you can do to make this more muscular and make it have a bigger impact in another person's brain.
Yeah, I can tell just in the cadence, it's definitely art over writing.
Yeah.
This is definitely your passion. This is your art.
Like,
you can, because nobody's going to talk about it that way. For me, I looked at writing as a big task. It's an assignment. I got to go and write 1,500 words instead of just writing. And the craziest thing was, I would wake up at 3 a.m. after doing research and looking at shit and doing this and doing that. 3 a.m, I'd wake up out of the blue and just go and write the shit because I'm not thinking about it.
Right.
I'm the guy who writes, edits, and you're never going to get done.
I do some of that. I don't do the let it fly. We're going to do a shitty first draft and then make it better in the second draft. I mean, I do multiple drafts. Like, I couldn't number the drafts.
Yep.
Like, there's so many times of just looking at it. But
I feel like
the way that I do, I'll write the first paragraph and be checking it and building it. I kind of look at it more like a foundation.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, like if you're going to build a house.
But that's...
Yeah, if you're going to build a house, you wouldn't, like, build it once over and then, like, okay, now we'll...
knock it all down.
or now we'll do the second layer on top of it. Like, I don't just do that. Like, I would build the fucking left corner strong, make sure it's fully supported. You know, make sure that first paragraph is really good and I know where I'm going, and then do the second paragraph. And, you know, and that doesn't mean that later on shit won't get moved around, shit won't get changed, cut, whatever, but I like my first drafts are usually pretty strong because I am stopping and editing as I'm going through it.
Is it a time thing, like, with you? Do you know how to, like, put that certain schedule, or do you have to, like, take way longer to knock things out?
I mean,
are you good on deadlines, or are you more like
I'm good,
like,
on deadlines,
like, deadlines versus writing a book, right?
Well, books have deadlines too, but it is a little different. It is a little more controlled. I am good on deadlines. I am historically good on deadlines. I mean, among the group of writers that I came up with, Dream Hampton, Scott Polson Bryant, you know, Bones Malone's in there, you know, some other great people, that generation, I was known for being on time with my shit. I mean, like, I was always like, if Tuesday is the deadline, it's like, well, does that mean 9 a.m. or 10 a.m.? And I will freaking have the shit for you at 9:59 a.m. in your email or whatever it is.
Yep.
Like, I mean, I took this shit very seriously. It was a profession to me from the very beginning. And it was like, I know what I need to do. Similar to an athlete. An athlete knows, if I'm going to play the game at 7 p.m., mm-hmm. then I need to be eating this at 12, doing this warm up at 2, doing this cool down at 4, you know, gassing up, you know, steroids up at 6 so I can
give my butt shots.
Yeah, so I can be peaking at 7:38, you know, and have energy through the end of the game. I know that pace. You want 1,500 words. Mm-hmm. That means I need to spend this much time, and so I can start that here, and then, and you know, I will be. I spend a lot of time planning.
That's what it seems like. It seems like you're very meticulous in the pregame.
Well, in Sunday Sunday nights, I look through all the things that I want to accomplish over the next week, month, 6 months, year, whatever it is, all that shit. I have a podcast that I'm doing. I have two books that I'm working on. I have two TV shows that I'm working on developing. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's a bunch of different projects, and there's a couple other projects that I want to put seeds down for the future, you know, and offshoots of those five major buckets that I talked about. So Sunday night I would sit down and think about, like, what do I want to do and what do I need to do to keep moving these different balls up the mountain? And then I look at my week and I say, okay, so when can I work on the different priorities? And I start to see, like, okay, this Migos story has to be done by Friday. That means I need this kind of chunk of time Thursday, Wednesday. Don't have it Wednesday because I have to do this, this, and this. So Tuesday, I have to get to this position. Mm-hmm. So then on Thursday, I can, you know, I'll be on the green and I can just knock it in the hole. Because Wednesday, I will not be able to work on it. I'm trying to be super aware of that sort of shit. I just never want to be in the all-nighter position.
Where you just, you know. So you don't need that pressure of the deadline. You work extremely organized. Create your buckets.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you can be hyper focused when that time comes on that task.
Yeah, 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 yeah. I don't need the deadline. I mean, like, if I know where the deadline is, I can. I don't need.
But the pressure of the deadline.
I don't need the deadline. Yeah. I need the deadline so that I know what you need for your publication. Yep. But I don't need it to motivate me. Like, I'll be done before the deadline.
Yeah, it sounds like your planning game is crazy. What are your organizational, like, what do you use to organize? Is you really just drawing everywhere?
A lot of it is pen and paper. You mean for an essay, for a book?
No, just kind of in everything you just kind of explained,
pen
right?
And paper.
You just said five different things in these five different buckets and then moving into this and to organize.
I have a moleskin. I will sit and write out the goals of the week. Mm-hmm. And that might be 30 different things from, you know, I need a new Blistex. I need to make sure that I run 6 miles every day. You know, I need to make sure my son gets a new book because he finished his other book and he's bitching about it. He doesn't have a book to read for reading time. To, I got to finish my Migos article. To, I got to get, you know, so-and-so from the Times on the phone to see if I can talk to them about let's do stuff in the future. So it's all different levels of stuff. You know, it's not just professional goals, but it's all sorts of personal. But these are the things I got to do this week. So when am I going to do them? And partly based around where can I give myself a big chunk of time to write? Mm-hmm. Like 4 to 6 hours of, like, this is the writing time, and trying to structure the day around creating those sort of things. Where what am I doing for the next 6 hours is writing whatever book or essay has to get done.
And what does your space look like? Do you have, like, a writing space that just you're secluded, or can you write anywhere? It doesn't really matter.
No, I need quiet. I need
like zoned out. You throw headphones on, or just quiet.
No, I need quiet because you're kind of juggling different ideas in the mind. You know, I'm looking at a text that is. I'm trying to create this essay, this book, this chapter, whatever. Where are the different things gonna go? What do I need to put in? Am I moving toward this story, or am I going to make that point before I get into that story? A lot of the writing process, the its feel for me.
Yep.
So I needed to be quiet because I need to be able to hear a lot of the ideas that are going on in my mind and to be able to, like, okay, I'm going to use that story, but I'm going to use it later. So put it back here and then pull this other thing out. And if I have somebody else talking, you cannot get as deep a level of concentration if other words are being said.
You automatically gravitate towards them, and then you start listening to that.
Yes.
To go.
Or it just breaks your train of thought.
Yeah.
So I need quiet. I mean, you know, at this point, you know, we live basically in a big loft. So I sit at the dining room table and get it done. And, but, you know, it gets done during the day while the kids are at school and at night when the kids are in bed. I can't work outside of where it's quiet.
Yeah, I've been working on I used to try to do all my notes and stuff on my phone.
Sure.
For some reason, writing it down physically sticks so much more.
Oh, absolutely.
But then I end up having 10 different Moleskines or notepads and then forget where I wrote shit and looking around. And then I get frustrated with that part.
Mm, well, I'll Moleskine it out and then figure out a week that ticks off as many of the goals as realistically possible. Always keeping in mind, what is the big goal? I never want to get overwhelmed by the little goals. Mm-hmm. Right? The big goal is to get a book done.
Mm-hmm.
The big goal is to, you know, to keep doing a great podcast every week.
Yep.
You know, that's pretty much it. You know, what do I do to support those goals? And there's other financial things, there's other little life things that intercede, but, you know... So I'm building the schedule around how to create significant blocks of time to get those big things done. And then I'll put it in the phone. And so I'll have a big Moleskine and then a sort of for like the look at the week.
Yep.
And then a smaller one for like, so this is what the day is going to be. And at the end of the day, I'll look and see, what did I not get done? What can I move forward to the next day or next week? So this Moleskine is like, what am I doing today? And trying to deal with, you know, because your day always gets disrupted. You have
always
a plan for the day.
Always.
It gets pushed, this and that gets pushed aside. So how do you deal with that? I sometimes feel like I spend too much time planning. Because if I finish a task, then I get into the paralysis of like, okay, so what's next? And so triple checking, because I already decided after I do this, I'm going to do. But then I'm like, as I do the math again, is that what I'm going to do next? Okay.
Yeah, I get guilty of that. It's called over paralysis.
Mm.
I mean, paralysis by over analysis.
Mm, yes.
I'm guilty of that all the time, man. What do you consider like your biggest hurdle so far in life that you've had to kind of get through?
My biggest hurdle that I had to get through? What is my biggest hurdle that I had to get through? I don't know. Probably just learning how to deal with people.
Okay.
Learning how to, you know, just come across well to people. You know, I think I have a good heart, but at times in the past, I may not have expressed it. I may have made what I thought were jokes that other people did not find funny. I may have been too argumentative that turned some people off. You know, I may have said things that I didn't realize would offend other people that did, and it took me time to really realize, like, you know, you can mellow out here and you can sand off the edges there and get more flies with honey, you know. Which doesn't mean kissing everybody's ass, but I think for a time in my life, it felt like a foreign language. Like, how do I deal with people? Easier to deal with a mass of people in terms of an audience than to deal with individuals and not make mistakes and not feel like I'm repelling or offending people who I actually like and want to be friends with, or just not knowing fully how to reel people in. I mean, you know, I've had friends, but I've been something of a loner for a lot of times and not always wanting to be that, but getting focused in my work to where it's like, you know.
Was that competitive? Like, is it a competitive thing? 'Cause I feel like you're super competitive, right? Like,
I am.
But quietly, right? Like, you're not going to run out and be like, yo, I'm going to beat everybody, but you'll shoot them.
I mean,
you know what I'm saying? Like,
I mean, and sure. I mean, among things that are comparable, sure. I mean, like, I definitely felt competitive with the other writers who were brand names during that whole 10 to 15 year period where that's what I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
Hell yeah. And
but maybe that's why you didn't make friends, or you felt loner-ish?
Well, it wasn't about them. I mean, like, I am friends with them. I can call Scott or Dream or, you know, a couple other people, you know, Cheo, you know, any time. You know, those are sort of big friendships, and like we talk about big ideas and, you know, meet on a certain level, right? And they're not like day to day. I mean, like, I've been super close to those people.
Mm-hmm.
But that was a long time ago. I mean, just a lot of other people. I don't know how to describe it. You know, I have definitely learned a lot from looking at, you know, what was that book? How to Win Friends and Influence People, and some other books about just how to relate to people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and trying to see how can I talk to you in a way that matches the goodwill that I have for you and not miscommunicate how, you know, because I was never a hater.
Mm-hmm.
I liked people. But I think when I was coming up in New York, I didn't always know how to express myself in ways that matched, you know, the goodwill that I had for folks.
Yeah, I can actually relate to that. Yo. People always say I talk down to people, or you talk to people in how I react to people. It's in, like, I'm short, is what my wife would say with people.
Mm.
And it was never on purpose. It was never out of ill will or me trying to be an asshole. I don't know. I expect people to be smart, I guess. And when they don't, I react a certain way.
I always knew you didn't want to have a dumb small talky conversation.
No.
If I wanted to talk to you, I had to see, you know, I always thought you were tough.
Not at all.
Way tougher than I could ever be.
Not at all.
I always thought that. And you were serious. And if I wanted to talk to you, I had to, like, you know, it wasn't
really?
Gonna be like
serious?
Yeah, what's going on? I had, like, you know, like, I talked to you about sneakers, I could talk to you about sports, I could talk to you about hip hop, but, like, you know, you were definitely one of the people who I was like, you know, you got to say something meaningful. You can't just, I never liked small talk anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, he's not going to talk to me. I have to talk to him if I want to. Like, I have to say
that's
something.
That's so weird, though. I would, from my side, I would never think that because I'm the shy guy. Like,
really?
Yeah. Like 100%. So that's even part of me doing this is coming out of my shell in a sense. Right? Because I'm definitely the shy guy. I'm definitely the person that isn't as outgoing as people think I am, which might partially be part of the persona, right? Or the facade or whatever it is.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's like, that's really ironic that you would, like, because I'm usually in my mind, I'm the happy, I'm hanging out, I'm chill, I'm relaxed, I'm whatever.
Right.
But then people are always like, yo, no, for real, you kind of wound up.
You're very
up.
Serious. You're a very
really?
Serious person.
I definitely don't.
It's definitely like, to me, it's like,
I'm probably just always high. Like, that's probably really all it is.
Maybe.
Like,
maybe.
The rage of the red eyes. You know?
The rage of
like,
the red
that's
eyes.
That's all I can think it could be. Like, but for people to think that of me is such far from exactly how, like you said, how you feel in your heart and what you want people to think of you.
Right.
Like, that's not at all what it is. Right. I actually struggle with being social in the sense of being not in a social setting, like we're out and we're hanging out and we're in an environment, but being good with just being in contact with people.
Mm.
Like, I mean, I have thousands of people I know. And I got only a few of friends that you really consider friends in, sure. in those circles.
Yeah.
But even that, it's, I struggle to communicate constantly.
Mm.
I get so wound up into my bubbles and the family, like, right? You get caught up in family easy. And man, then you're like, oh shit, I have to actually do work. And then you're like, oh, I got to do work. And then it's like, I want a little time for myself just to chill. And then you're like, oh, I'm asleep.
Mm.
You know? And then it's like,
I work till like 2 a.m. because I'm trying to, I could never have a day where I felt like I didn't accomplish anything.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm constantly like, what are you doing? What are you doing? What are you doing? What are you doing? And if I don't have a good answer, I am doing research. I am, you know, sometimes I'll accept I am procrastinating a little because that's part of it.
Mm-hmm.
I accept that. There's a little procrastination that's acceptable in a creative practice.
Mm-hmm.
It's okay. You have to have the mind that says, okay, get back to it. You know, I can't zone out on fucking Slither for fucking an hour. I can zone out on it for 10 minutes and then get back to the fucking third paragraph.
Mm-hmm.
But don't act like, oh, I could get to 20,000 again. I love that fucking game. Yeah.
You know, I lost that one. life. It's a fucking miracle, right?
Indeed.
What else can we talk about, man? What else do we go through as adults? Family, man. How much does family change? I mean, we got kids.
Yeah.
9, 10.
Yeah.
Right? How do you juggle?
Oh, I was saying every moment. I'm like, what are you doing?
Mm-hmm. Constantly asking yourself.
Make sure you're doing something that is progressing you. I want to be a better writer. I want to make more money. I want to spend quality time with my kids. I want to be better at tennis.
Mm-hmm.
So what am I doing? Am I running to build my lungs? Am I, you know, cleaning up the kitchen, you know, because I want my wife to be happy when she wakes up in the morning to a clean kitchen and not a stack of dishes. You know, am I, you know, trying to, you know, whatever. Every fucking minute I'm trying to be like, what are you doing? What are you doing? What are you doing? So I could always go to bed being like, okay, I was productive today.
But it's a positive, what are you doing? It's not like, bro, what are you doing? You're not doing shit.
Mostly positive. When I'm not doing shit, then there's more of a conversation of like, you're not doing it, let's go.
And motivational, right?
Yeah.
No pep talk.
Yeah, and it might be, well, I need to procrastinate right now because I'm upset about what just happened. So that could happen, you know. But, you know, you have to have a conversation with the I need to procrastinate voice. You know, and you know, I mean, like, I, you know, I mean, like, I keep up enough on movies and TV. I'm not 100% working all the time.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean,
but I can cut out social life, which has long term impacts. But I can definitely be like, I don't need to go to that party. I don't need to go to hang out with you. Like, I need to work. And you know, every day for the last like 15 or 16 years, I've had a book due.
Mm.
It's been like a constant process. If I didn't have a book due, I was working on the proposal for the next book.
Wow.
And some of them you haven't seen.
Yep.
I worked on them for whatever reason. The projects fell apart. So, you know, some people might be like, he spent 15 years working on 5 books. Well, that would be bad math, but a lot. But like, no, there's at least three others that didn't come out. So then you can start to see like, yeah. And I'm working on 2 now. So, I mean, like,
do those become failures at all? The books that don't come out, or they just don't come out and it's cool?
One of them was a novel, and I guess I have to look at it as a creative failure. I mean, like, the publisher didn't want it, you know, and which motivated me to be like, see, you're not a novelist. You should be doing nonfiction. So I made the pledge to do that, to focus on nonfiction and not try anymore with fiction. But the other two that fell apart were not my fault, and I lost years on Hot. I mean, Mike is hot shit. Oh my god.
And now it's stuff you gotta do for other people?
Yes. Oh my god, some of that shit is so good. And it'd be like, you'd be like so like wrapped up in the culture, like, you wrote the book on KRS-One, like, whoa. Like, you wrote the book on, like, Nas, like, whoa. Like, niggas don't even need to read the shit. You just know, like, he wrote the book on Nas. Like if I had been able to get that plane landed, oof. God forbid some shit happened and I landed in jail, I'd be good.
Yeah.
You wrote the book on Nas, like, leave him alone. Like, we even read the book. Actually, they probably all read the fucking book, like, twice, yeah. Like, three times. But, like, nah, man, you know. And, you know, there's sometimes, you know, shit happens, there's nothing you can do.
Shit happens. What are you going to do? But that's a great attitude to have.
I mean, like, there's a way that great athletes have that amnesia.
Yep.
You know, where they forget.
Yep. That next shot. It's just about the next shot. And the next shot.
I missed 10. That means I'm due.
Mm-hmm. I'm gonna hit this next one.
Right.
I know I'm gonna hit this next one.
Drop two passes, throw me the next one. Mm-hmm. You know, or even the best is when, like, they beat us last time. Like, let's go.
I'm gonna beat the shit out of this time. I mean, that's what happened to me with meditation. So I fell off. I had 178 days straight.
Wow.
And I fell off a day.
How did you fall off?
We had an event, and I had woke up late, got into it, and I was supposed to come back after we prepped and then meditate. And I completely just spaced out. I would have killed myself over it.
Why didn't you do it before you went to bed?
I just spaced out. I just forgot.
Oh, you just went to sleep without...
Yeah, I just didn't remember. Because it wasn't part of my morning routine.
Right.
It flipped. It changed. Right. And then I didn't stay on top of it. Right. And then after that, it just fell to the side.
Oh, the whole practice?
No. No, no, not at all. I said it would have.
Oh,
before.
That day. Mm.
The next day, I woke up and was like, y'all did 178. I'm going to do 180 at least this time.
Okay.
So kept going. So I'm at like 25 or 26 now.
Oh, new streak.
New streak.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, my wife does that. She was searching for something, and she's like, come on, you know. And so I said, okay. So we went to this introductory thing that her friend introduced us, that brought us into. The guy introduced me to TM, gave me a mantra, and I did this shit.
And you went to the Transcendental.
Yeah.
Oh.
And, you know, anything that's like a thinking exercise, I'm like, yo, I can fuck with that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm down for that. That's my shit. And I got it. And I listened to a lot of Tim Ferriss. So then I started listening to like Tara Brach and like other meditators. And I had guided meditations that I did for a while. A lot of Tara Brach. Sure, shit was good.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want a guy leading me there. I want a fucking nurturing woman leading me through meditation. But I wanted to do guided for a while so that I knew I was doing it right. Because when I first did it, and I'm just sitting there alone thinking, doing the mantra, and then I'm like, what? Like, am I doing it right? I don't know if I'm doing it right. And who's that guy? God, who does the Sam Harris?
Mm-hmm.
I was listening to him on meditation. And he was like, why do you need a Sanskrit mantra? Like, what the fuck is that? Why do I, like, and from the beginning, I was like, why do I need to repeat this word?
Mm-hmm.
And So on Sam Harris, and he's like, that's not even part of, historically part of meditation. That's some Americanized shit.
Mm-hmm.
So I stopped so I stopped the mantra, but I would kept meditating. And they really wanted you to do it twice a day.
Mm-hmm.
And I just could not imagine finding 20 minutes in the morning to do it. The afternoon, evening, I could find that time. But, I mean, like, I had little kids at the time. Mm-hmm. Mornings with little kids are chaotic. 20 minutes is the difference between getting to school and, like, I'm just going to zone out for 20 minutes? Like, that's crazy. Like, I could never find that kind of time. And even once I put them in school, I'm like, I got to go. Like, I got to do my day. And I also personally did not find the difference.
Mm.
Like, I felt a difference, like, right after it finished. But, like, some lasting difference,
mm-hmm.
I didn't find it to where it would keep grab me back and make, like, I feel the difference when I'm running. Like, when I'm running every day,
mm-hmm.
you know, spiritually, sure, but just the physical growth and not being tired at certain points, like, that sort of thing. I just didn't feel it. And my wife kept doing it, and I was like, I want to take a break. I don't feel it. And I didn't miss it.
When you didn't do it.
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, I gave it a chance. You know, I may give it a chance again in the future. Like, I understand it. I respect it.
Mm-hmm.
I know that it's working for other people.
Yep.
A lot of other people.
A lot.
Who I look up to. The time that I put into it, it was not doing anything for me. Maybe I'll go back to it in the future at some point. But
I mean, but I don't think it's something you have to force. It's not like you have to do it. It's not a prerequisite for being a good person.
But I wonder what I would get if I could get the experience that others are talking about. You know, like what would be the fruits of that tree if I was really able to meditate the way other people are?
I mean, I don't know. You seem like so clear-minded on a lot of things, and your internal voice and dialogue doesn't seem off kilter. I think, like, for me, a lot of times that's why I do it. It's because of the noise, right? It's to kind of calm that, and it's to bring a focus on something as simple as breath.
Sure. No. Yeah. I mean, Tim Ferriss talks about, you know, like, having a hard time calming his monkey mind, and he spends the first 60 seconds, like, you know, futzing around, and I would never do that. Like, I could just
stop
and just go right into it, and, like, so, you know,
but you got to find whatever your thing is, and it doesn't necessarily have to be that. You could be running. Meditation is meditation for you. Praying is meditation for some people. Exercise is a meditation, is a form of meditation, and it doesn't have to always be still.
Sure.
You can have tons of active meditation.
Yes.
Right? And just be present in those moments.
Yes.
Right? So, you know, your tools are your tools. Doesn't necessarily have to mean they work for everybody else or for you.
Right.
And transcendental is a little, I mean, the mantra is, you don't necessarily need that, right?
Right.
The mantra is, I mean, for some people, that's a distraction.
Yeah.
Right? It sounds like it was distracting you, because you seemed like you were trying to make it focus on something, but then you're trying to, like, that's distracting you from the actual act of meditation.
It definitely was. It definitely
right?
was.
So I could worked
definitely
against...
get to quiet and avoid thought, right? And, you know, because I don't think you're supposed to be yapping. You're supposed
to
be doing your grocery list.
Yeah, no, you're not supposed to be talking. You're not supposed to have an internal dialogue.
Right.
You're supposed to kind of let thoughts naturally occur.
Yes,
and then kind of let them
go by.
Yeah, and let them go by.
And that increases the sense of executive function.
Yes.
But I was already up in that.
But that's what I'm saying. So it's,
I don't even know why I started to think about that. But that's like, you know,
because it's trendy and it's a conversation.
No, I mean, years and years ago.
Oh.
I thought about it before. I didn't know the term until I started reading about meditation. But, like, I was... not to say, like, I'm some brilliant person, but just this one thing I was thinking about in my 20s when I'm like, I'm going to make sure they have positive thoughts. I can control that.
Yep.
I can, you know, I can be on top of my mind rather than it controlling me. So for meditation to go into my life, I was kind of like, well, I'm already super conditioned into controlling. Not that I can always control it, but, you know,
but
I don't get bogged down in thoughts that I don't want to have or thoughts that are not positive, you know, that are not optimistic. For the most part.
But that's what we work on. That's the key, is having, again, you keep saying it, it's that choice. Yeah. Having that choice.
Yeah.
Right?
Hell yeah.
Let's have a choice. We'll get up out of here, man.
All right.
I think it was a good talk, man.
Hell yeah.
You know? Different.
Hell,
you know?
Yeah.
And we didn't even get into hip-hop. And I was curious how that would affect you and everything else, but I think we covered a lot of ground.
Do you want to talk about hip-hop?
I can always talk about hip-hop, man. Yeah, that's, that, you know, that's, because, I mean, that's what affected us, man. That's part of kind of why we wanted to have this dialogue. In hip-hop, we're not open to having a dialogue about, like you said, vulnerability.
Yeah.
It's the opposite, especially in the beginning years when we were coming up. I mean, there was no vulnerability. Not to that. It was, you know, I'm hard, I'm going to shoot you, I'm this, or I'm militant. And then, you know, you're taught as in that environment, man up. Don't be a bitch.
Yeah.
Don't be a punk.
Yeah.
You know, and if you talk about your emotions, you're a punk.
Yeah, no, I definitely was taught that, you know, yeah, we don't spend a bunch of time focusing on that.
You know, and that was just the narrative of hip-hop in general.
Yeah.
You know, but that's a whole other episode. Yeah, we could get into that fucking forever, man.
Yes.
Well, thank you so much. Any last words, any tools, anything you want to leave the children with?
Not that I can think of.
Yeah, I think we covered a lot, man. Choice. Yeah. I think choice is going to be the theme
indeed
of this one, man.
Indeed.
So everybody, make sure you guys have a choice.
Indeed.
Talk to you guys soon.